America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krawczyk. John, the title of the book that we're focused on in this podcast is Republic of Wrath, How American Politics Turned Tribal, from George Washington to Donald Trump. And let me give you the broad thesis of this podcast that we're going to be talking to this professor from Brown University about. And that is the fact, John, that if you go back, now try to wrap your head around this, John, because it is a little confusing. If you go back to the early 19th century, it was the Democratic Party that embraced immigrant voters, but they staunchly supported slavery. Okay, that was the Democratic Party at that time. The Republican Party, which tried to use a literacy test to block immigrants from entering the country, embraced black emancipation. So, okay, did you wrap your head around that, John?
Yeah, it's hard to believe. You know, you look back on history, how things change.
No, it is. It's amazing.
I got to laugh, but it is. It's very interesting.
Now, what's really interesting about our moment in time, because there's nothing new about the fact that we have angry and bristling politics in our society. That's not new. But what is new, and what we really focus a good bit on in this podcast, is that for the first time, the so-called minorities in our country, and let's look at African Americans, immigrants, liberal women and women's rights and such, they are all on the Democratic Party side now, while white Americans are more likely to be Republican. So therefore, instead of these intra-party squabbles where we came out and we could compromise because you had bigger tent parties, now we've got a lot more homogeneity, with one party on this side and the other party on that. And so the divisions are clear cut and very destructive at times as to getting any policy through.
Well, I think very destructive. I think, you see how and social media is driving it. And I think, you know, to somewhat expect the news is driving it. I mean, we really have ugly politics now. I think it's more ugly because the information we get is so kind of blurry that we don't know what to believe.
Oh, absolutely. But we've got these parties now that are really camped out more toward their extremes. Though I will say I think President Biden sees the need to bridge that gap and is trying to play to the center of our politics. But I think, John, we're going to find out in the next couple of months or next couple of years, whether that center still can hold an attraction to a lot of Americans. We say that we used to be a centrist country, and yet both parties seem to have pulled a little bit away from the center. So we've got to figure out how we can come back and get some policy directions that are going to move this country forward. Because, Sean, you know it yourself. There's a lot of anger in this country. A lot of people feel let down. They feel forgotten. And we've got to figure out how we can deal with this Republic of Wrath. And that is what we're expressing today on America Trends. With us on America Trends is James Marone. And he's written a wonderful book, Republic of Wrath. Now, I hate to say wonderful book in the context of what it is that you're describing, but basically, you looking through an historical lens at American politics, you say that we're loud, we're angry, we're bristling, it's us versus them, but what else is new?
Yes, thank you, Larry. It's a delight to be on your
podcast. That's right. I looked at American history with a question very much in mind, which is, it's so loud, it's so angry, as you just said, what's new about all this? And there's a lot that's not new. In the old Congress, back before the Civil War, one congressman said, those who are not packing a knife and a gun are packing two guns. They were beating each other up. There were over 30 violent confrontations, physically violent, including duels, screaming, yelling, lying. All that is really an old hat in American history. But there are a couple of things that are new. One, the great battles in American politics, if you just look over time, and I was shocked at how intense they were, really revolve around three great issues. One, obviously, is race, and you just can't understand, you can't underestimate how intense the race battles have been. I've been studying American history all my life, and I was shocked at just how furious our racial battles were. It sounds naive, but no matter how strong you think, it's even stronger. Second, nativism has been very, very powerful in American history. And third, when you get into racial and native battles, nativist battles, really battles for us versus them, that always brings in sexuality and gender. So those are the three great lines. Obviously, there's lots of others, but those three are huge in American history. And what I found, and what surprised me, was that this is the first time in American history where all three of those battles have been sorted out by party. We've never had a situation before where African Americans, Asians, Latinx, all the immigrants, all the so-called minorities are on one side, and the sort of white, slightly anxious nativists are on the other side. The party's always divided those battles. And I think that's one of the reasons our battles have gotten so tribal. When you ask the great question of American history, who are we? That always changing story, for the first time, the answer really falls along party lines. In the past, the parties divided them. The Democrats were the party of white supremacy. The Republicans were the party of nativism. Each party kind of reached out to different groups on the periphery of power. And this slowly over the course of the 20th century and accelerating after 2000, the parties really sorted that out. So the parties themselves inject the most furious culture war right into our politics. And when that happens, I think no one can quite see straight.
And I don't think most people go back and think about the true fact that we really did have big tent parties up until a point. And I think the point that you focus on is 1964 with Barry Goldwater becoming the nominee of the Republican Party. But I can remember a time when there were what were called Bon Society Republicans, and there were, of course, the segregationist Democrats. I know Joe Biden in the last campaign talked about some of the ways that he had to accommodate those various interests when he first went to the Senate. But how important a point was that when, in fact, the parties cleansed themselves of ideological diversity?
Yes, you're absolutely right. That is huge. And it really did happen in the 1960s. During the New Deal, going back to the 1930s, it soon became apparent that both sides had very strong left and right wings. The Democrats, of course, as you said, had the Southern Democrats, who were among the most conservative people in the country, and they had the Northern Democrats, who were very, very liberal. It's not that there weren't huge battles in that era. It's just that if the bullets were going to fly, they were going to stay on the same side of the aisle. Meanwhile, the Republicans had the Northern liberals, as you said, the Ripon Society, people like Nelson Rockefeller and George Romney. These were really quite liberal people. Jacob Javits. And what's really interesting is they relied on black votes. They were ardent civil rights activists because a very important part of their coalition were African Americans. right through the 1950s, where Dwight Eisenhower did very well with the black vote. And meanwhile, the Republicans also had John Birdside-y people who were extremely conservative. So both parties had a wide spectrum of people. In fact, it was the Republicans who absolutely saved the great Civil Rights Bill of 1964. Mm-hmm. Democrat liberals were for it. Democratic Southern Democrats were filibustering it. Time magazine called it the Republican bill, because when Everett Dirksen, the Republican majority leader, sat down, he rewrote the bill. They used to say about Everett Dirksen, "Ev, are you loquacious? Please limit your answer to 1,000 words. But when it came to civil rights, he was the hero. He rewrote the bill, and the Republicans joined the Democrats, and the Northern Democrats, and saved the Civil Rights Act from the Southern Democrats' filibuster. Now, through this period, the 30s, late 30s, 40s, 50s, and early 60s, the Republican conservative wing kept eyeing the Southern Democrats and saying, look, here is a natural coalition for us. If we could combine Republican conservative and Democratic conservatives, we would go from a constant minority party to a majority party. And they managed it in the 1960s. In the 1964 National Convention, the Republican moderates were routed for the first time. In fact, it was an amazing convention. I was shocked just reading the descriptions of this convention. Part of it was jubilant conservatives, genuine, honest conservatives like Barry Goldwater, who really wanted to reclaim their party from the Northern liberals, because they had what they called, and they could make a very strong argument about this at the time, a freedom agenda. On the other side of this convention, and it was very clear from the press descriptions, was a howling racist mob. And the two groups lived side by side. Jackie Robinson, I was shocked to read this, the great baseball player, he wrote in the black press, it was front page news in the black press, that he felt as a black Republican delegate what it must have been like to be a Jew in Nazi Germany. That really, that editorial sent shockwaves. People, he was afraid people would get into a fist fight with him. They were so angry. They were calling him the N-word. And so here you had genuine conservatives in the Republican Party. And they permitted, or at least they didn't stop, the racial animosity, which had been part of the Democrats, to crawl into the party with them. And we then had this takeover of the Republican Party by the strong right, both genuine, honest, liberal, libertarian conservatives on the one hand, and the old Southern Democrat segregationists on the other, who now slowly but surely come into the Republican Party and make it a very fierce kind of party. And the Democrats now become the liberal party. They're washed of their conservative wing. And so both parties come out of 64 heading towards the present, which is now parties with much less diversity. Democrats, the party of liberalism, so they still have a kind of old-fashioned, you wouldn't call it a big tent, but a bigger tent, and Republicans really focus now on a conservative agenda.
But that long Southern strategy, in a sense, where Southern states that were Democratic in whole then became Republican in whole. And, of course, Richard Nixon was able to take advantage of this. I've got to ask you about Richard Nixon and Kevin Phillips and all this, and then we'll move the story forward. But Richard Nixon was very interesting because, as you point out, he blended liberal and conservative ideas. Even universal basic income was something he was working on. National health insurance, the EPA, came about under him. And then, of course, the thought leader at that moment in time, a lot of people may ascribe a lot of these notions to Pat Buchanan when he came along, and he was a part of the Nixon administration as a speechwriter. But you take us back to Kevin Phillips as a very important thinker in this realm.
Absolutely right. On the one hand, Nixon was really a public policy genius. If you're a liberal or a Democrat, you have essentially been living in the shadow that Richard Nixon cast. His family assistance plan, as you just said, would have gotten rid of AFDC and welfare, as Clinton eventually did to a large extent, but given a minimum income to every person in the United States. So just imagine, the liberals today would love to have a plan like that, but it would be far too radical. And there was Nixon saying, we don't have to have all these programs, just give everybody a minimum income. And the National
Health
Insurance...
And by the way, in many ways, that was an idea that came from the conservative icon of economics, Milton Friedman.
Absolutely. I was at Chicago in Milton Friedman's day and knew him, admired him, though, of course, he was seen by most people as a kook back in the 1960s. By the 1970s, he had persuaded conservatives that this would get rid of the whole welfare establishment, a minimum income, and pave the way to free markets, because, hey, everybody would have money to spend. We wouldn't have to be giving people welfare. They'd have their own money. So yes, it was a Milton Friedman plan, and it's too bad Mr. Friedman isn't still around, because he was so persuasive when he made that argument. But Nixon completely went for this with his family assistance plan, his welfare reform, and in national health insurance, we still live in the shadow. No single president since Lyndon Johnson, I would say, was more creative. But since Lyndon Johnson, no one was more creative rethinking national health insurance in a market-based way than Richard Nixon. You could really say that both the Clinton and the Obama plans are great-grandchildren of the of the Nixon plan. We could talk more about that later, but your point is that he mixes this very liberal set of ideas with the Southern strategy. Kevin Phillips, this policy wonk, young policy wonk, writes a book in 1968 which tells Nixon what he already knows in his gut. He sends it, Nixon does, to Ember of his staff. And Phillips says in this book, look, the Republicans are fighting against voting rights for African Americans in the South, but hey, this is in your interest. You can create a majority coalition by taking the South, which does not want to be in the same party as African Americans, take the white South, and take the backlash against civil rights in the North. Now, it's 68, after 4 years of riots, remember, as well as a backlash that had been exposed by the Southern segregationist George Wallace when he ran for president in both 1964 and later, and just combine conservatives and the Southern backlash against civil rights. The non-African-American party is a vast majority party, says Kevin Phillips. The New York Times wrote a review of this book, and it was a lamentation. It says it's a very sad day when people vote not on the basis of the policies they'd like to see enacted, but on the basis of their race and religion and caste.
I mean, we're not really talking about economics so much. We're really talking about who are we. And even when President Trump, as he was doing a tour of Georgia for Senate candidates, said, you're a victim. Who was he speaking to? You're a victim.
It's the us versus them, and it's exactly right that Phillips and Nixon saw it, and Nixon took the great white angst about civil rights and said it softly, just with winks, so that people could be in a coalition.
Law and order.
Yes, lots of law and order. There were lots of code phrases, and law and order was a very powerful one that he made powerful. What law and order meant, as several black writers put, sadly, law and order meant a black man with a knife. But here's what happens. You have a party of anxious whites, allied with absolutely honest conservatives, But anxious white people not only gathered to the Republican Party, but over the second half of the 20th century, the beginning of the 21st century, they see their numbers dwindling. The Census Bureau threw a stick of dynamite into our politics in 2005 when they were crunching the two census of the year 2000. They said, well, it's going to be a majority-minority country. Now, people dispute whether the Census Bureau was right, but that really created a sense of angst among that portion of the white population, which had gone into the Republican Party, and felt anxiety about their race. I remember being at the dump in Leominster, New Hampshire, and hearing two guys talking, and one of them said, if we don't stop immigration, we'll never elect a Republican again. We'll be lost. And I just thought, that's the feeling. We'll be lost. So our us and them politics, which has always been an important part of American politics, right back to 1800 and the first contested election, now feels really dire. We have a party of all the minorities on the one hand and a party of anxious white people that includes all the anxious white people on the other hand, and a diminishing whiteness, according to the Census Bureau of America. That is a recipe for an us-them politics like we've never seen. And
well,
Trump's genius is to see that.
James Marone is with us, Republic of Wrath, How American Politics Turned Tribal, from George Washington to Donald Trump. And I must say, it's such a readable book. I would really encourage you, if you really want to understand where these divides are today, why we have such tribalism, let me read just something from another author, and that being Ronald Brownstein in The Atlantic recently. Donald Trump didn't start the electorate's resorting along the lines of transformation and restoration, but he has made the process vastly more intense and venomous. Throughout his divisive, belligerent, and norm-breaking presidency, Trump has governed as a wartime president for red America, where blue America, not any foreign nation, as the adversary. I mean, I really thought about that myself when, in fact, the president began speaking, President Trump, I'm speaking of, about, well, the states that were most infected at one time with the coronavirus. And he was speaking as if the blue states had to be excluded from your thought process because they were the others, as opposed to almost a Confederate red America.
Yes, that's really well put. And when it was a Confederate America versus a the free states, the parties both shattered over that. Remember, the election of 1860 had four people running, one from the north and one from the south of each, basically of each party. Now the parties just project this right into politics. That quote you read from Brownstein is right on the money. The way I read this is like this: when Nixon played the race card, he could do it very softly because 90% of the electorate was white. So as long as he was getting a majority of that electorate, just an occasional whistle and an occasional wink, an occasional advertisement, that was enough to do that. By 2012, it wasn't enough. You remember the Republicans had their autopsy after Romney lost.
Mm-hmm.
What Donald Trump understood, and none of us thought this was possible, was that you could squeeze that last anxious Confederate white vote out of the electorate and still make it a majority, still make it close enough to a majority to win the election. And that's what he did with his riling up. He wasn't doing anything substantively different than Nixon did and all the and a lot of people since then, but there were fewer people rally that way, and so he had to scream at the top of his lungs. And the good news, I mean, and there is good news here, is that if he had just been a little less angry, he might have won the election. Republicans did incredibly well in this election of 2020. But at the end, I think the public said, no, there's only so far we're willing to go in this angry shouting. 70 million people followed him over that. So it's the us and them is still very powerful. But
and by the way, I would argue, as I did in a letter to the editor in my local newspaper, that in fact, had it not been for the pandemic, and the fact that these incontrovertible facts which were affecting so many Americans, whereas a lot of the misinformation that had been taken from the bully pulpit and spread across social media was so powerful that if these facts did not intervene, regrettably, a pandemic, I think he would have been reelected.
I would have predicted exactly that. I think you're absolutely right. And a pandemic certainly gave him a chance to be a populist for more people. The point you made earlier about the us versus them in his rhetoric, it's red America against a declining, threatening blue America. He had a great opportunity to put that aside when the pandemic hit. And I completely agree with you. His failure to do that, his essentially banging the same drum he had banged for 6 years, more really, that cost him the election. I would certainly say that. When you look at how close so many of the states were, so many of the states hurting from the pandemic, like Wisconsin and Georgia, I think that probably was enough. That and the economic decline that came with the pandemic. Everybody else's polls went up, governors across the country, red and blue, but his went down. So I think you're right. That pandemic was the difference.
And you do have many ideas for us as to how we might begin a repair of American politics in this republic of wrath that we are now living in. You say that the real problem is not in the disagreement, but in a political system not well suited for two parties pressing for advantage with no quarter given to either, where we're not willing to compromise any longer. And of course, this is leading to all kinds of problems in policymaking where nothing is getting done. Look how long it took even for stimulus conversations to move forward. So let me ask you, what are the types of reforms? Because we look at trends here in our country, and to the extent that you have brought up to date as to where we are, how do we begin to break this logjam, or is it just so emotional now, Professor Marone, that it's impossible for us to break out of the tribes that we're in and see the other side?
The one optimistic thing I'd say is that when you read history, what's most striking is things are always changing. What we take absolutely for granted today will no longer be true 10 years from now. So hang on to your seatbelts. It could change for the worse as well as the better, but things are always changing, and the key is to make them change in good ways. Now, I think the first thing, what really strikes me reading American history, is how the founders never took seriously the idea of the right to vote, guaranteeing the right to vote. Incredibly, there is no right to vote for president in the Constitution of the United States.
And by the way, that stunned me when I read it in your book. And that's why you have to read this book. So explain that to us.
The founders never envisioned parties. They hated parties. They thought that the republic couldn't last without parties. So when it came time to decide how to vote, they just said, well, let the state legislatures decide. They'll decide who votes and how. And that's never been changed throughout our history. And I can show over and over again the extent to which it's really up to the state legislatures. In Bush v. Gore, the famous Supreme Court case of 2000, the majority is perfectly explicit. They say there is no constitutional right to vote for electors for the president of the United States. And they say, moreover, that by federal constitutional law, not state laws, by federal constitutional law, the legislatures may take back the power at any time. They just didn't pay attention to it. All the efforts to really address this directly have been cast aside. So the very first reform we have to make, and I think Democrats and Republicans ought to join in on this one, is to say, hey, let's submit a constitutional amendment that simply says, as they proposed it back in 1869, all citizens of the United States have a right to vote in every election in the state where they reside. That's a direct quote. It only got 5 votes in 1869. It was too radical because it would have let Irish people vote in Boston and Chinese people vote in California, so they couldn't have that. But today I think we might be ready for it. And believe me, just having that right in the Constitution would be a big step forward.
By the way, now, before you go on with more of the reforms that we need, I'm just curious, was that
well, lack of a provision in the Constitution, ever part of the renderings that Donald Trump and his minions put forward in the many court cases during the aftermath of the 2020 election?
Yes, yes, they were the gang that couldn't shoot straight, and they had the very difficult problem of facing reality. But that was the exact logic of calling the legislators in Michigan and in Pennsylvania and telling them, please set your own slate of candidates. They had read Bush v. Gore, and they had an idea that the legislatures could take back their constitutional right to select electors. Now, it violated some state laws, but that could always be changed. What they hoped was that the state legislatures would change the state laws, saying we are now taking back the right, and that the Supreme Court would uphold that. And I have to say, if this election had been a little closer, I would have really been worried about the kinds of pressure that would have been put on the state legislators. As it turned out, it was so far from true. But that is exactly the logic that Trump, as you say, and his minions tried to take.
Number one, what we have to do. Well, you say, first of all, again, in the book, at the end, change takes time, but politics is always changing. So that is that optimism that we're going to move past this very difficult moment in time. But you say secure the vote, turn more people out to vote. And we did that in 2020. So what does that mean? I mean, have we taken up your clarion call in this book?
The trouble is the right to vote is still a product of politics. You know, it's a couple of my favorite political scientists say it's like Calvin ball. I don't know if your listeners remember Calvin and Hobbes, but old Calvin, when he played Calvin ball, he made the rules up as he went along, anything that would help Calvin win. And that's how our electoral system works. And you can see this now with various legislators proposing crazy things. I mean, the system held this time. But the truth is, any state can change the electoral system at any time. For heaven's sakes, let us get a set of rules that are fixed, that are tight, that lets all citizens vote, and then let the lions of competition roar. But we have to have competition over politics and policy, not over the rules themselves. And I would hope when the dust clears and Trump has exited the stage, that Republicans will take a look and see that Trump's first premise, that a large turnout hurts Republicans, is false. A large turnout will, I think, really help us, because it would take party politics away from the most intense voters. We know that the really, really intense, crazy people on both sides are a small minority, but they dominate the primaries, and they end up vote dominating the conversation. I think an electorate this large, if we could keep it operating under clear, sensible rules, and we're moving in that direction, will slowly but surely move us away from this intense us and them. And notice, if you're looking for some positive signals, sadly for Democrats, there was a lot of ticket splitting this time. This was not just an electorate, largest electorate since 1900. This was not just an electorate that could see only blue or red. This was an electorate that was ready to split its ticket. And I believe as we have very large turnouts with rules, we will get more and more of that. The people in the middle will start coming in, the people who aren't as passionate about politics and who are willing maybe to listen to both sides, that they'll start coming in. So I'm a big believer, and I think both Democrats and Republicans, but especially Republicans who resisted this, will be helped in the long run by having a large turnout in election after election. And I really hope.
But how easy is it to wrest the electoral machinery from gerrymandering to whether mail-in ballots have to come in a day before, 10 days before? All these tricks
various methods of suppression and such that really have been really intensified and gotten more sophisticated over time. I mean, how difficult is it to make it something that is more civic and more nonpartisan?
It is very difficult. This goes all the way back. It's built into the Constitution. It's not easy, but this stuff is easiest done in the shadows. It's a little harder to get away with in broad daylight. And we now know, in a way we didn't really know, in the past, that this is something to worry about. So I think reformers of every stripe, conservative and liberal, can start focusing on this in a way that they didn't focus on before, realizing that really the Republic is at risk now, that it's gone so far, it's become so extreme, that we really need to look to our electoral system if we're going to stay as a republic. So the intensity of the problem and the visibility of the problem, I think, will be a big help. Let me toss another thing at you.
Sure.
In terms of reform, people are shouting about getting rid of the Electoral College, and the real problem of the Electoral College is not just that it permits minority government, but that it means that for people in most states, there's no presidential election at all. Good, strong minorities in New York or California or North Dakota find that their vote simply doesn't count. They've never seen a political advertisement even. Back in the original, each state divided its electors, its electoral college, by the percentage of the vote in that state. If Trump won 4/10 of the vote in New York, he gets 40% of the electors. That would give us presidential elections that would count every state. And it wouldn't be quite – I understand that Democrats will now say, oh, let's get rid of the electoral college altogether and just go with popular vote, and Republicans say, in your dreams – but this is a more subtle reform. It could be done without a constitutional amendment, and it would have the huge advantage that everybody would be in play, and it would completely change our presidential elections. So all of a sudden, North Dakotan might say, gee, it'd be nice if we weren't taken for granted. And the Republicans in California could say the same thing. It would really change our politics. So that's another reform.
They've already done Nebraska and Maine.
Yes, so Nebraska and Maine have started on that. They started down that road. I would be even more radical than them and say just divide it along the popular vote. Of course, Nebraska and Maine solution, they give the winner of each district in the state, but that raises all the problems of gerrymandering on stilts.
We've done
a percentage basis
on gerrymandering. Let me ask you in closing a couple of questions. One, President Biden trying to say, come together, let's reason together. His admonitions or his call for crossing over the aisle is not met with anything but a cold slap. What's that going to mean? How important is it that we see some of this coming to be with a leader who actually is attempting to do this in earnest?
I think if you were a betting person, you would not bet on people coming together. And Biden could be in real trouble if he spends too much time trying it. But the danger is that we have had a steady erosion of congressional power, authority, which is what the Constitution intended. The Constitution intended Congress to basically be the decision-making body. The executive is to execute. That's been diminishing, really, for the last 20, 30 years. Each president extends the power of the presidency further. What will happen now, Trump really stretched it, but before him, Obama stretched it too. And it is just going to get more and more so. So Republicans, I think, ought to sit down and think, do we really want to pass power even further to presidency? They might answer yes, because it helps them get reelected. Just get people friendlied enough and you keep winning reelection. But, oh, what a high cost there is to see power going to the presidency and with that to the courts. 4 more years of that will really get us in a place where Congress becomes increasingly irrelevant, and the battle of American politics is the battle of the presidency and the courts. And that is not what a constitutional system is meant to do. It's a real danger that we become basically a president-run country, in which the president simply rules and then stands for election every 4 years. It's not what the Constitution intended. It would be a real change. We would essentially rule ourselves like most South American countries, which copied our Constitution and have had a long legacy of strong populist leaders who simply dismiss their legislatures. We are heading in the same direction unless we can come together. So the danger is great on that particular score, essentially a presidential system.
Very well and disturbingly said. Let me go back to the most salient point, although there are many in your book and your thinking, about who we are at the essence, and the fact that race, immigration, and feminism really do define us so clearly today. And now we've got all the others in one party, and we've got the white shrinking majority in the other. And, of course, there are those who cross over that line, and many women this time did in suburbia. But you say, and this is really something for us to walk away with in our thoughts, divided societies always struggle with memory. And I think that is so important to be said and said again. I can't tell you the number of people with whom I interact who have no sensitivity to the black experience in America and how defining that has been throughout the history of the Republic, and yes, our original sin, but it continues to dog us as one of these problems and issues that we have never truly grappled with.
You know, that's beautifully put. I couldn't put it any better than that. And the thing, it really struck me as I looked at the different periods of American history, just how violent our racial history is. We tend to think of it as an occasional riot here, an occasional riot there, an occasional slaughter here and there. But if you look at the period, for example, after the Civil War, first you had the horrors of slavery, and they can't be understated. And then the period after the Civil War, it was just one horrible massacre after another, with African Americans striving with incredible bravery to stand up to a violence that was searing beyond belief. And then, and here's the point you just made, Larry, and it's such a good one, and one I really try to emphasize in the book, what's remarkable is all that's forgotten. Every now and then, a historian will publish a book saying, oh, how about this slaughter? How about this mass murder? How about this set of lynchings? And we all sort of running, oh my gosh, that's a terrible thing. But the sheer perpetuity of it, and then the way it's been lost from our collective memory, is just an astonishing and sad thing. And I think simply remembering will help us grapple with the very difficult situation we're in. If I could just make everyone really appreciate the kind of history we've had, if we could make everyone, and you're doing your bit, and thank you for that, I think we would have an easier time facing our current problems, just understanding how difficult our racial division in particular, but also our nativism, has been in the past. So remembering is the first step towards fixing, I think.
James Marone, what a pleasure. The book.
Oh, it's really been fun. Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Oh, thank you. Please read this book. I really encourage you to do that. And I thank you so much for being a part of America Trends.
Great. Thanks. Really enjoyed it.